You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
And a really huge welcome to this session. It's really great to see so many people here, even if it is just because of the rain and that you're trying to keep dry. It's also nice for us because we're dry and on comfortable chairs. So very sorry, but we're having a good time here. So my name is Melanie Nazareth. I'll be hosting this session, and I'm the church's project officer for Green Christian. You may have seen their stall just by the hothouse. I also work with a group called Christian Climate Action, and they're two of the three Christian grassroots sort of organizations that are working on the issue that we're going to talk to you about, which is about the climate crisis, the rise of the right, and how the two are interlinked and what you can do about it. But before I do that, before I introduce you to the panelists, the organization, those three organizations, would really love for you to keep in touch. And so I'm just going to tell you about them because we're going to send round some clipboards so that if you want to take the opportunity to get involved in some of the work that we do, you can sign up on the clipboards that we'll be circulating. We'll also be circulating some invitations, which are to an event that Operation NOAH is running with Greenbelt in London. It's another panel discussion that follows on from this one, so it is also Hope in a Divided Age. So let me tell you first briefly about Operation NOAH. Operation NOAH, in fact, campaigns for UK churches to divest from fossil fuels, but it also looks at their investment in climate solutions and protecting and restoring nature by adopting sustainable land use. Now, they do this by releasing reports on these areas. They host listening meetings, strategy sessions with campaigners, webinars, and in-person events. So this is not the only one. Keep a lookout for what they do. Because what they do is to bring people into working on the institutional structures of the church to bring change. If Green Christian is more your cup of tea, we're a group of ordinary Christians from all backgrounds and traditions. Inspired by our faith, we care for creation through prayer and action and encouragement. And so whether you're a church leader or a church leaver or a campaigner or a contemplative, a warrior or a warrior, then Green Christian can help you to be a change maker in your church, in your country, just in your own life. So the last of our three organizations is Christian Climate Action. And we are a community of Christians who, inspired by faith and social justice and the movements of the past, we engage in prayer and public witness and direct action to urge those in power to take meaningful action in response to the climate and nature crisis. So if you sign up on the sheet that's going round, you can sign up for the newsletters of all those organizations and find out more about the work we do. Now, we have a great panel, all working at the coalface of this issue. I'm afraid that we're probably going to have a little less interaction than we had originally intended, so you can hear a bit more from them, which is great. Let me introduce them to you. We're going to start by exploring with Cameron Conan the context of the increase in anti-net zero and anti-climate action rhetoric that has come with the rise of populist politics and the mainstreaming of the far-right political agenda. And Cameron is an environmental campaigner and the communications officer for Operation NOAH. Cameron was a co-leader of Citizens UK Just Transition campaign. He's a key part of Operation NOAH's Bright Now campaign, which has helped to make billions of pounds of assets off limits to fossil fuel companies. He's also campaigned on environmental issues with his home church, which is St. Mary's in Walthamstow. And lovely to hear from you. And very lucky you are to have such a wonderful congregation. As a former journalist now working with climate communications, Cameron has worked with reporters and editors at The Guardian, The Times, Al Jazeera, and the BBC, among other media organizations. So it's good to have you with us, Cameron. So Cameron will set the scene, but then we will then begin to think through this issue more theologically and spiritually with Al Barrett. Now, Al is a Church of England vicar in Hodge Hill in East Birmingham. So you've got some supporters in the audience. If you are members of Al's parish, you too are very lucky. Because since 2010, Al has been on a long-term intergenerational journey of community building with his neighbours. He's a trained wild therapy practitioner, he's a theologian, an author, and he seeks to nurture spaces of love and care and justice amid the fallings apart of the world. So thank you, Al, for being on our panel. And finally, we'll hear a bit about how you can move from anxiety to action in your local church and beyond, with Claire Fussell. And Claire is the campaign director at Operation NOAH, where she leads initiatives that equip churches and Christians to respond to the climate crisis through practical action, through advocacy and financial stewardship. She's had 2 decades of experience in environmental campaigning and movement building, and has held leadership roles across the charity and faith and environmental sectors, including the Climate Coalition, Christian Aid, Church of England, and she's really passionate about linking Christian faith with environmental action. So, let's have a start with Cameron. Over to you.
Okay, you ready for this? It's a whistle-stop tour. I'm going to go quickly. I'll start by saying, as a young journalist, I was told once by a senior editor of mine that I should always follow the money when looking into a story. At 24 years of age, I found this to be incredibly cynical. And yet, very soon after he told me this, I found it to be very good advice. In fact, it's also a very good place to begin my brief overview of the financial links between political movements and the fossil fuel industry. Now, let me start with a bold, but I think, at least in this audience, relatively uncontroversial statement, which is the fossil fuel industry is one of the wealthiest industries in human history, which may explain why the industry still invests almost nothing in renewable energy. Now, a 2022 analysis using World Bank data revealed that the oil and gas industry has delivered, get this, $2.8 billion a day in pure profit for the last 50 years. $2.8 billion per day in the last 50 years. The professor who conducted that research, who is an energy and environmental economist at the University of Antwerp, said this: "It's a huge amount of money. You can buy every politician, every system with all this money, and I think that's happened." He says, the money protects fossil fuel producers from political interference that may limit their activities. The money protects fossil fuel producers from interference that may limit their activities. Okay, so I want to set the scene for you. So what I want you to remember there is the fossil fuel industry is one of the wealthiest in human history. $2.8 billion a day in pure profit the last 50 years. And it's enough money to buy every politician that you want. Okay, so here's my part two of our whistle stop tour. My part two is, in 2024, the United States Representative Jamie Raskin, who's the ranking member on the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability, along with a senior Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who's the chair of the Senate Budget Committee, released a report. Here's the name of the report. It's a mouthful, but I think you'll understand why they've named it this. Denial, Disinformation, and Doublespeak: Big Oil's Evolving Efforts to Avoid Accountability for Climate Change. Now, this report wasn't just produced in a few days or a few weeks. It was a 3-year-long investigation by Democratic staff of the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability and Democratic staff of the Senate Budget Committee. here's what it found. Some of you will know some of this stuff, but it's good, if you do know it, it's good to hear it again, because somehow it's always just as shocking when I hear it again. Documents demonstrate, I'm quoting from the report, documents demonstrate that fossil fuel companies internally do not dispute that they have understood since at least the 1960s that burning fossil fuels causes climate change. And they then worked for decades to undermine public understanding of this fact and to deny the underlying science. Okay? That's a key part of this report. They've established this. Here's another bit I want to pass along. Big Oil's deception campaign evolved from explicit denial of the basic science to deception, disinformation, and doublespeak. So there's a lot more in the report, but I'm just going to give you a few other things. Big oil companies made public pledges to support the Paris Agreement with never intending to do so. They privately lobby, either directly or through trade organizations, against pro-climate legislation. They use academic programs at prestigious universities to influence policymakers and shape international climate policy. And they track, here's an alarming one for some of us in this tent today, they track activities of climate activists and environmental NGOs that they deem to be a threat. So they basically operate like a mafia, is kind of what we're saying. According to the report, fossil fuel companies also use trade associations, think tanks, and other nonprofits to influence public policy proposals and messaging. And they use them to lobby for unpopular proposals that they do not want to be associated with. And it's very true that, and I've been saying this for years, if you go to lots of fossil fuel companies' websites or you see adverts they've run, they often feature solar farms and wind turbines and things of this nature. They do virtually none of that, and they have no intention of doing it. So that gives you a sense, just from sort of cherry-picking some elements from that report, gives you a sense of what the fossil fuel company gets up to and how they operate. Now here's my part three of our whistle-stop tour, and I'm just going to give you some examples of how this plays out in real life. Okay, so I've got four of them. I'll see if I can get through all of them before Melanie buzzes me, because I'm not sure. But my first is this. Every year, fossil fuel lobbyists essentially take over the COP UN climate change conference, which, along with influence of petrostates like Saudi Arabia, goes a long way to explaining why the international process to transition away from planet-heating fossil fuels is so slow and so difficult. Let me give you an example. Last year at COP30 in Brazil, more than 1,600 fossil fuel lobbyists were granted access to the climate negotiations, significantly outnumbering every single country's delegation apart from Brazil, the host nation. At COP30, fossil fuel lobbyists accounted for one out of every 25 people at the conference. The Guardian figures, and the group that they quote, figures that about 7,000 lobbyists have been given access to UN climate summits over just the last 5 years. And here's the last thing I'll share about the COP process. In 2021, in Glasgow, when we had COP in Scotland, and this was more than 25 years after the COP process began, before they began meeting every year, it was the first time that any formal COP resolution even mentioned a fossil fuel. The first time in 2021. Not even the landmark Paris Agreement mentions the term fossil fuels, just greenhouse gas emissions. Now, why do you think that is? Here's my second case study. In the spring of 2024, Donald Trump proposed a quid pro quo arrangement with nearly 24 fossil fuel executives. Look it up. Not a conspiracy theory. It's a real thing. He met with them at his private club at Mar-a-Lago before that year's presidential election. He proposed that if oil bosses gave Trump $1 billion for his re-election campaign, he would roll back the Biden administration's environmental regulations. But not only that, Trump, who's a long-standing climate denier, also dangled other possibilities in front of these executives, including increasing oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, removing hurdles to drilling in the Alaskan Arctic, and reversing car pollution rules. A whole range of stuff. Well, fossil fuel companies didn't quite deliver on what Trump wanted, Though they did spend nearly $500 million in the last election cycle to influence Trump and Congress. But it didn't matter. Trump's basically given them everything they could have ever dreamed of, including revoking the endangerment finding, which is a 2009 declaration made by the U.S. government, which is the foundation of basically every environmental protection in the United States. It basically says greenhouse gases are a threat to human health, and therefore we can legally regulate them as the government. Trump's overturned that. So that's kind of where we are. And as we know in this country, Trump has continued to insert himself into UK environmental decisions, most recently pressuring Andy Burnham to open the North Sea to new oil and gas. There's Trump. I'll try not to mention him again. My third case study is this. According to a 30th April report from DSMOG, which is an environmental research organization and media outlet, Reform UK, you guys know who Reform UK is? I bet you do. They've received £24 million from oil and gas interests, accounting for more than two-thirds of their total income. DSMOG's analysis reveals that one particular donor, Thailand-based crypto billionaire Christopher Harborne, you may have seen his name in the news, he donated the biggest chunk, $22 million. Harborne has a firm called AML Global, and they basically sell jet fuel, which is made from crude oil. The party also accepted £230,000 from management consultancy First Corporate, whose owner is the former chair of the Global Warming Policy Foundation, which is the UK's foremost climate denial group. Not coincidentally, Reform UK has vowed to scrap net zero, end subsidies for wind and solar, approve new oil and gas, lift the ban on fracking, and open new coal power plants. So that's their agenda. Here's my final case study, and this one's particularly near and dear to my heart, because at Operation Noah, we led a campaign to confront this person. If you don't know his name, I hope when you leave today, you will, and you'll remember who this is. He's called Sir Paul Marshall. He identifies as a Christian. He's associated with Holy Trinity Brompton in London. And he is probably one of the most powerful non-elected people in this country. He co-owns GB News. He runs one of the biggest hedge funds in the world. And he's the owner of The Spectator and Unheard. Part of the problem with Paul is some of the things he said and then his news channel, GB News, which, according to researchers, had broadcast 953 attacks on climate science and climate action just around the 2024 general election alone. The channel has also platformed a think tank, which in the past has received funding from the fossil fuel industry. Now, Paul is on the record in saying decarbonization, or net zero, is leading the way in wrecking our industrial base, impoverishing our people, and sacrificing our energy security. So in Paul Marshall's estimation, relying on a highly volatile, expensive commodity that's largely controlled by rogue states and cartels is dangerous, or not dangerous. That's basically the safe way to go. It's really dangerous to produce your own energy with infrastructure. That's Paul's take. 30 seconds left. I'm almost done. The broadcaster Ofcom is also investigating whether GB News in breached rules on impartiality and material misleadingness when they showed, sorry, I said I wasn't going to mention his name again, when they showed an interview with Donald Trump where Trump said climate change was a hoax and it went unchallenged on GB News. And Marshall has also refused to meet with any of the 120-plus Christian leaders who signed an open letter to him earlier this year. That's my whistle-stop tour. There's more to say. Thank you for listening. Now Al's going to give you something really interesting. Thank you.
I
was just going to say thank you to Cameron, and thank you for the applause. I hope that now you have got some idea of the depth and breadth of the extent to which the fossil fuel industry and anti-climate action are really linked. And the final link that Cameron, the example that he gave, is the link with our faith, our Christian faith. So none of us can say that we are outside the influence that these fossil fuel companies have. Al is going to now, I think, give you a more perhaps hopeful perspective about this.
I'm not promising that. Should we just take a moment to pause and just let what we've just heard go from here to somewhere around here and just notice what's happening in our bodies when we hear not just information, but some truth about what's happening in our world? So let's pause for a moment. And I'm going to change key just a little bit. At least two significant things happened for me last summer. The first was I found myself breaking into my local river. I'm going to tell you a bit more about that in a moment. The second was that there was a protest outside my local hotel that houses asylum seekers. And in the latter, a group of us from our local church went to listen to the protesters. And these are four things that we heard. The first is that they were angry. They were angry with the people in the hotel, and they were angry with the government. The second is that they had been fed and they believed a narrative that our economics and our politics are a zero-sum game. If someone wins, someone else loses. And primarily, the narrative that they believed was that this was a zero-sum game between white working class people and immigrants. Immigrants supported by woke lefties. And there may be a few that tick some of those boxes in this tent today. The third thing we heard was that each of those protesters who were angry lived lives that felt really fragile. They were people who were facing the sharp end of unemployment, of homelessness, of a sense of lack of safety in their communities. And those are real things. Those are absolutely real things, and they're the kind of things that should make each of us angry. The fourth thing that we heard was a sense of loss. Loss of a sense of belonging, loss of a sense of pride, loss of a sense of a place that they could call theirs, that they could call ours. And the protests were some small way of clutching at some of those things that they felt like they were losing. Which takes me to my second story about the river. At the bottom of my road is the River Tame. It's a river that connects me with my own ancestors. It runs alongside one side of our estate for about 2 miles. And for all of those 2 miles, it is entirely fenced off. There are signs saying, private, keep out. Our river does not belong to us, or at least we can't get to it. And so one day I went for a wander, trying to find a way to my river, to our river. And the only person I met along the way who challenged me was a man in high vis whose one question was, what company do you work for? Which, as a vicar in the Church of England, is a slightly complicated question to answer. But isn't it interesting that the assumption was that the only reason I'd want to get to my local river was that I had a commercial interest in it? And so underneath my two little stories, there's an older, bigger, longer story here. It's a story of the privatization of rivers and of land that goes back to the 11th century, if not before. A story of enclosure, of common land, of places that belong to all of us, the commoners, places that we could call ours. And the enclosure of that common land led to lost livelihoods, lost connection with the earth, lost connection with each other. And often we call that story urbanization. But it's the same logic that invaded other lands and called them ours. The same logic that enslaved other people and labeled them as less than human. The same logic that saw the earth as a resource to be owned and mined and extracted and commodified. It's the logic of the plantation. And who benefits most from enclosure and privatization and plantation? The very richest who hoard resources and wealth and power. The system that we live in isn't broken. It's doing exactly what the system was set up to do. To break things up, to extract profit, to make the richest richer, and to divide the rest of us from each other. And the system is built on at least four denials. And these from decolonial activist Vanessa Machado de Oliveira. She wrote an amazing book called Hospicing Modernity, which I highly recommend. Four denials. Firstly, the denial of violence. The system lives on violence. Violence to human beings, violence to the earth. The second denial is a denial of our limits. The limits of our planet, the limits of our system, the limits of us as human beings. The third denial is the denial of our entanglement with each other and with the earth. We are intertwined. We are connected together. We need each other. And anything that tells you otherwise is a lie. And the fourth denial that I want to add to Vanessa's is the denial of the sacredness of the earth and of each other. And those denials are sin. It's a very short and powerful word that we Christians have. Those denials are sin. And sin, we know as Christians, is both out there in the structures around us, in the people that benefit the most from those structures, but it's also in here. And so if whatever we're going to do about this stuff needs a conversion, both of our structures that we need to call to dust, but also a conversion of ourselves. We need to remember that we are dust and to dust we shall return. We are earth creatures. We're made of the stuff of earth. And that unites us together. I want to end with two things. Valerie Kaur, Sikh activist in the United States, says that when we start losing a sense of wonder, we are able to do unspeakable things to each other and to the earth. When we lose our sense of wonder, we lose our capacity for empathy. And when we rediscover our sense of wonder, that is the beginning of returning us to love our neighbors and to love the earth. So I want to call us back to wonder today, to pause in front of the earth beneath our feet, and in front of the human beings that God made in front of us, the human beings outside the hotel and the human beings inside the hotel, to pause with wonder in front of them as sacred mysteries, with wonder and curiosity. Who are these? Who is this earth beneath our feet? Who are these human beings who we disagree with often? Who sound different to us, who look different to us. Who are they? What's the mystery that they come with? And then lastly, a dream that I received by that riverside, because I found a crack in the fence and I scrambled over a few walls and down to the river and I saw a cormorant just under the M6 motorway, just down further on the river. And I paddled my feet in the river and I had a dream. Not quite as grand as Martin Luther King's dream, but a dream nonetheless. A dream that those fences that fence us off from the river are broken down. A dream that those asylum seekers inside the hotel and those protesters outside the hotel are able to come together down by the riverside as the song goes, as that ancient spiritual goes, to lay down our swords and shields and meet each other on common ground. And to know that that common ground is holy ground. and to love each other and to love the earth and the rivers underneath our feet with a love that means we will care for it and we will fight with every inch of our being those systems and those structures that will destroy and exploit and divide. That's my dream.
Thank you. Thank you, Al. And for all you said that wasn't going to be hopeful, I think that is incredibly hopeful. The idea that we hold in our hands the way to combat the system by being human and recognizing the humanity in each other. So thank you. And if I now ask Claire to tell us a bit more about some of the things that we can do that should make us hopeful because we can take action.
Thank you. Yes, I think thank you, Cameron and Al, for laying out the sources of division that we see in the world around us. And those are powerful statistics you were sharing, Cameron, about the fact that division isn't accidental, it is intentional and is fed from the fossil fuel industries who want to keep the status quo, and by the powerful who want to hold on to power. And the question for us here today is, how can we as Christians, how can we as the church unify in the face of that division, expose that division, and take action together against it? And I like that vision at the end, Al. I mean, woohoo, that common ground that we all share and we all celebrate on the banks of the river together. How can we find that common ground in the work of our churches? And first, I want to think for a moment about what we experience when we read the news and read the headlines, which can be often in direct opposition to that philosophy of common ground and unity. I think there are three. The first is, well, these are the headlines about climate change I'm talking. Firstly, total despair. The Amazon is on fire. Fossil fuel companies are richer than ever. We've passed multiple climate tipping points. There's no going back. There's nothing we can do. We're all going to die. Does that sound familiar? And we were listening to Ruth Valerio earlier, who was talking about how we've moved now from the predictions about climate impacts to the reality of climate impacts. It's our lived experience. And a lot of the headlines are just despair every day, and that has a toll on our mental health. The second we're confronted with is false optimism. It's all going to be okay. Lots of people have electric cars now, don't they? And we have more renewables than ever before, and the cost of them are falling every day. It's all going to be fine. We can fix this with technology. There are technological fixes. We don't have to worry about it. There's no need to campaign. And the third is eerie silence. If you pick up particular broadsheets, there's no mention of climate change. There's a lot of distraction. There's talk about celebrity culture, travel, culture, family life, and sometimes other false divisions around stirring up, like you were saying, Al, pointing the finger at immigrants as being the cause of all of our woes, rather than looking at our shared planet and the ecological breakdown that we all must address together. So despair, delusion, and distraction. And I think that these positions can all be unhelpful in different ways. They can obscure the truth of the situation we're facing. They can divide us by setting up differing narratives, and that leads us away from collective action. But we know, don't we, that the truth is that climate breakdown is happening, it is driven by human action, and we urgently need to transition away from fossil fuels, and every 100th of a degree matters in avoiding the very worst impacts. And to do that, we need to be collective, we need to come together and make substantial changes to our emissions and loudly hold our banks, our governments, our corporations, our polluters to account. But that's not often the discourse that we see. And I wanted to outline those three common narratives because it helps to explain my next point, and that is that there is hope, there is good news. And it is that the vast majority of the world's population already wants stronger climate action. Yet it is dubbed the silent majority because it doesn't know it's the majority. These false divisions, this false kind of multiple discourses distract us from the fact that we're already united. And last year, the Guardian newspaper launched the 89% Project. And it highlighted how a growing number of peer-reviewed scientific studies have worked out that 89% of people globally want stronger climate action, but I'll quote their report saying, individuals around the globe systematically underestimate the willingness of their fellow citizens to act. And the result is that we feel alone, we feel sidelined, and so we fall silent. And silence allows this illusion of division. It stops us from realising that we largely agree. And we'll tackle the 11% maybe in another talk, but we're talking about the 89% today. And that becomes a spiral of silence because we think, I care about climate change, but I don't think that people like me really care about climate change, so I won't say anything. And because I don't say anything, other people think that nobody cares, and it's just a downward spiral. But why is that good news? I was promising some good news. Well, I think that's good news because people don't need to be persuaded to care about our common home. They don't need to be persuaded to care about the climate. They already do. Instead, they need to realise that they're not alone and then come together to act. And the Climate Majority Project released a paper this year called Mobilising the Silent Majority. And that concludes with four pillars that I think are particularly interesting for us as Christians. The four pillars that need to be in place to move people from that place of silence to that place of action. The first is truthfulness, creating space for honest acknowledgement of climate risk. And the second is actionability, focusing on practical responses that allow people to act meaningfully at local and national levels. The third is collective efficacy, so making it visible that others are doing things too, and that our individual actions can contribute to a wider response. And the fourth is emotional, and I would add, spiritual sustainability, support people as they face these difficult realities without becoming isolated or overwhelmed or polarised. And what is the church good at? Speaking truth, taking meaningful action, bringing people together, providing spiritual and emotional support. So when I was reading this, I thought, this is what church is. And if it's not, this is what church should be. And church is already bringing people together who hold different views, who vote differently, who are different ages and backgrounds, and we find common ground. Our faith communities can help make this silent majority visible through holding good conversations that lead to collective action. So the Climate Majority Project gives these four pillars for mobilising people, all of which I believe our churches are naturally expert in. And I'd like to offer four ways our churches can play a role in uniting around climate action. And so I have four words for you to remember and go away with and think about how you can, in your churches, to use these four words to spark unity and action. Speak, change, serve, and influence. Firstly, speak. Our churches can help people see the reality of the climate breakdown around us and talk about it. And I've been so encouraged to see that there have been around 3,000 screenings so far of the People's Emergency Briefings. And hundreds of those have been in our churches, and hundreds more I know are lined up through Season of Creation. This is a fantastic springboard for community conversations about the truth of the situation, being truthful and thinking about what we can do about it. We can also bring climate regularly into our church life, into our worship, our prayer, our teaching, not just once a year, not just a climate Sunday sermon, but regularly creating honest spaces for conversations about fear, about our hopes, about what does faithful action look like. And groups like Operation Noah, Green Christian, Christian Climate Action provide materials that you can use year-round to do that well and do that honestly. So churches must talk about what matters. Secondly, change. Our churches must be places of action. It's not enough to just talk. We need to get our own houses in order and show leadership in transitioning towards green energy, green banking, green buildings, and more. We need to make sure we're using renewable energy. Many of you already know this. You've done it. You've written the playbook. We need to bank with fossil fuel accounts. We need to make sure that our churches are part of the big bank switch to fossil-free accounts and that we're encouraging people to think about their personal banking as well. I'm sure many of us are already eco-churches and on that journey to using that as a framework for practical changes, showcasing that in our local communities, bringing people into the conversation about what can we practically do. And looking at our investments, money is power, as we've been hearing about. Follow the money. Let's not keep our investments at arm's length. Let's not leave it to the treasurer. Let's not think about these questions. Let's not just give it to CCLA and let them make decisions about what our money is doing. Let's speak about holding our churches and our denominations to account for what our money is doing. What's it funding and what could it be doing better? So churches must embrace practical changes as well as talking. So we're talking about speak, we've talked about change. The third was serve. Our churches must be useful to our communities. And in a time of real climate impacts that we see in our communities now, over the summers we've just had where our churches have been cool spaces, sometimes the coolest spaces in our towns and villages, we must open our doors and be spaces of haven in a time of climate breakdown. And I know that, Cameron, we have been talking about St Mary's Walthamstow opening your doors in times of fire, in wildfires. I know many churches have been a place of refuge in communities that have been affected by unprecedented wildfires this summer. So our churches must be a practical place of refuge and serving of our communities in a time of adaptation and dealing with the impacts that climate change that's very, very real and on our doorsteps. And finally, we've got there to the final one, influence. Churches can use their power. British churches collectively hold tens of billions of pounds in investments. We've talked a bit about investments already. And they also have significant land holdings. The Church of England alone is one of the 10 biggest landowners in the country. And we have bishops in our national government, for better or worse. That's where we are. And let's use them as well. We have power. And we should be using our collective wealth, our collective land, and our collective influence to make our use of land and our use of money work for nature and climate. So Operation Noah, do I have one more minute? I'll be quick. Oh, is that not? Oh. you're just agreeing with me. Oh, good. Thank you, Melanie. Oh, I'm out of time. Oh, sorry. Well, can I just... I'm on my last point. So we're running at the moment with Just Money Movement that you can spot just on the side of the hot house here, a roadshow called the Green Investment Roadshow, calling on denominations and churches, looking at practical ways in which we can use our money and our land for nature and climate restoration. And so please do come along, find out more about those. There's some information at the Green Christian and the Just Money stalls. And keep that conversation going. So change, serve, influence, and speak. Let's try and create that common ground together in the face of division. Thank you.
So now we're going to ask you to do a bit of thinking and a little bit of work. I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to allow you to process what you've said, and then I'm going to invite you to talk to the person next to you. So let's just have a minute. Sorry, if you can't hear me, let me just give you the chance to think about things for 2 minutes. Okay, I'm afraid that if we are going to have some time for questions, you're going to need to draw your conversations to a close. But can I invite you to continue them after the session? If you've got involved in a good conversation with someone, make the time to carry it on. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to have a bit of a Q&A for about 10 minutes. We'd like you to keep your questions very short because we've not got long. And could you just say who you are directing your question to? Because we'll just have one person answering your question. Okay? Could you just stick your hands up? There's a roving mic that'll come round. This one here.
Just to let you know that the roving mic has a lead, so you'll have to kind of meet. Oh, there was one back here first. Yep. Sorry. Great.
Great. Okay. Hi, my name's Al Lowe. Message for Cameron, really, or a question, and it's about the aviation industry. And if you like, connection between being Christians who still fly and the idea that as Christians we talk about the environment, but actually when it really impacts us, we do actually nothing about it. And is there a campaign that says, can we do a no-fly pledge? As part of our Christian activity?
I have a friend who runs a campaign called Flight Free, and it's a great campaign. I mean, I think we would encourage Christians or anyone to fly as little as possible. For some people, you know, it's more difficult if they've got family abroad and may need to travel to see them occasionally. But I think absolutely. Though I will say very briefly, the individual carbon footprint that you're meant to calculate was developed by the fossil fuel industry to basically put the problem back on the individual. That's not to say that individuals do not have responsibility to do it. So it's a sort of paradoxical thing. But I would note that about the carbon footprint.
Thank you, Al. As a fellow parish priest, you're the priest not only for those who are fully behind you and desperate to have action on this and feel the frustration, the grief, but also for those who have bought into the counter-narrative and find this frustrating, think it's a waste of time, distraction, ruining everything. How do you make space for that meaningful action whilst not pouring fuel on the fire of division?
Thank you. So I think it begins with that holy ground of encounter. Because those of my parishioners who have bought into climate denial, xenophobic narratives are still human beings too. And I think what I was wanting to say in my bit earlier was that actually often the buying into that stuff comes out of a place of fragility, insecurity, pain, anger, fear. And that, you know, that stuff is human, and all of us have our fragilities and insecurities and fears and pains. So that's the starting point, I think. I think in this conversation, we can't ignore the question of class and economic injustice, because actually for many of my neighbours, the reason the far-right narratives are attractive is because actually government in all kinds of forms has let them down over the years economically. And so, you know, the fact that the system that we're describing is an ecocidal system has to sit alongside the fact that the system we're describing also doesn't benefit a whole load of people in this country as well. So the economics is really important to hang on to. And then I think my third thing is that building spaces of community where people feel like they can belong, where people feel like they matter, where people feel like they have gifts that are valued and taken seriously, is the space where people can begin to see the truth of the systems that they're in and to find ways of acting against them in solidarity together. So I think, you know, those spaces of community become spaces of agency. And I think I will just... I know we're all about hope here this afternoon in the title, but the reality is that there's a hell of a lot of really scary shit happening in our world. You know, 600 people in Nepal died a couple of days ago. There's going to be more and more of that, whatever we do at this point. we're not going to be able to roll that stuff back. And so I think we need in our communities to create spaces that can hold space for fear and uncertainty and grief in the midst of the scary shit that's happening already. And in the midst of that, for that not to be paralyzing, but also for there to be space for action within that. So I think before we get to hope, I want to start with love, and love that drives us to action.
Hi, I work in the environmental field, and I've been following the climate crisis for 40 years before anybody talked about it being a crisis. And if anyone's in any doubt about the nature of the crisis, 10 years ago, we looked at fires in Australia, 5 years ago, Portugal, this year, it's here. And I think one of the problems is that we mix too many different important but separate subjects. When your house is on fire, you haven't got time to save the cat. You need to put the fire out. And we need to disentangle the absolute imperative of solving the climate crisis from other political things. I would gladly be a Green, except I hate the rest of their politics. But I do want to do something about the climate crisis. So I think we need to excise this existential threat of the climate crisis from everything else so that we can actually focus on it. Anyone can reply to me.
Well, I think Claire's going to reply to that, but I just want to say that actually it's almost impossible to disentangle this, because the impacts of the climate crisis are so, so intersectional. They amplify gendered injustice, it amplifies poverty, it amplifies everything. And so although we need to tackle that, we can't ignore all the other issues that go along hand in hand with it and that also contribute to it. Because this is a somewhat circular argument. The people move to this place of fear because their other needs are not met. And therefore, we are unable then to tackle the climate crisis. And they're attracted to parties on the far right, to narratives that distract them from the climate crisis. So I'm going to disagree with you, but I'm going to ask Claire to take that a bit further.
Well, I think that I'd agree, Melanie, that it is all entangled for the very good reasons that you suggest. But at the same time, I do believe that it should be above party politics, and there should be cross-party agreement around the action, the urgent and extreme action we need to take as a nation and globally to combat that. And I think that's one of the things that the People's Emergency Briefing calls for, is for a COVID-style national televised emergency briefing for all people to explain the scale of the crisis that we face and to take in hand cross-party governmentally what we're going to do about it, so that the urgency matches that scale. And I think that, yeah, so I'm going to sit on the fence and kind of say I agree with you both.
I think the danger of taking an entangled approach is that it can become overwhelming and paralyzing very quickly. But I think the danger of not taking an entangled approach is that actually people like me, who tick multiple boxes of privilege as a white, middle-class, straight man, largely non-disabled amongst others, can claim that I know what the most important thing in the world is right now. But where black and brown bodies, for example, are dying in this country because of systemic racism, we can't disentangle and say this is the most important issue when actually the system that kills black and brown bodies is the same system that is killing the planet. What we have to do is find ways of not letting that become overwhelming and paralyzing to our action. And so I think what we need to do is tell a different story about the world and about human beings that enables us to begin to live into a different kind of world that does not allow the system that kills bodies and the earth itself to continue to flourish. And that ultimately, that in a sense, that's the theological point here. We as Christians are being invited to live into a different world. And that might sound a bit airy-fairy, but actually that is the urgent invitation of today. Because if we live our lives into that different world, then the systems around us will crumble. And in some ways, the systems around us are crumbling already. And we need to be building that different world in the ruins.
Thank you. That was a perfect note, I think, on which to end. We have run out of time, but also that is a really important answer, I think, for us all to think about and take to heart. I hope you will continue to have these conversations outside this tent. If you would like to continue a conversation with someone who is a climate activist, there are people wearing Christian Climate Action t-shirts all around, I can see them, who have come partly to have conversations with you if you would like that. They're the black t-shirts, the white circle, there's a cross in an hourglass. Thank you to this venue for hosting us. Thank you to everyone on this panel. And actually, the biggest thank you to you, all of you, who have come to listen, to think about this issue and to do some work, some internal work on it. I hope you have a blessed and rich Greenbelt.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.